You might remember Gina Naba as a public radio producer and host. She tells us a fun story about this music. Some years ago, I was stopped at a traffic light and heard Johannes Brahms' Symphony No. 1 on the radio. It dawned on me, after many times listening and playing it in orchestras on the violin, that Brahms channeled his predecessor, Ludwig von Beethoven. What you hear, at least what I hear, is a familiar rhythm. It's the ba-ba-ba-ba from Beethoven's famous Fifth Symphony Open. The young Brahms cleverly passed this famous rhythmic tattoo among the various voices in the orchestra. Sometimes it's in your face, sometimes it's subtle. Brahms didn't stop there. There are other nods to Beethoven in Brahms' First Symphony that have been well pointed out. For instance, the nature of the broad, stately theme in Brahms' finale has been compared to Beethoven's Ode to Joy, when critics of the time pointed out the similarity to Beethoven's Symphony No. 9. Brahms retorted, "Any fool can hear that." Brahms was well aware that he stood in Beethoven's shadow. Beethoven, after all, is classical's greatest of all time, or as music writers say, G-O-A-T, GOAT. He opined, "You have no idea how it feels always to hear the tramp of such a giant, Beethoven, behind you." That was a lot of pressure, she says. Brahms was born 6 years after Beethoven died, and he was just 20 years old when composer and music critic Robert Schumann complicated matters by declaring him, Brahms, Beethoven's heir. The pressure of such high expectations terrified him. That's why Brahms took nearly 2 decades, from early doodles and sketches to final product, to complete this First Symphony. Once he cleared that hurdle, the music flowed freely. He completed his other 3 symphonies, each in less than a year. The looming shadow of Beethoven was and is legendary, intimidating numerous composers who followed him. Besides Brahms, great symphonists like Mendelssohn and Mahler felt his presence. David Korovar, a pianist and professor, said Beethoven had a similar effect on his contemporaries, including his teacher. Poor Haydn, Korovar said. Joseph Haydn realized his student's genius, and it changed his focus as a composer. Haydn pretty much stopped writing instrumental music and turned his attention largely to choral works instead. Beethoven, by the late 1790s, made such an impact that Haydn, who after Mozart's death, briefly got to revel in being the greatest composer in Vienna. Well, he found himself again eclipsed, Korovar said. Gina Naba continues, "In some ways, 2 centuries later, Beethoven continues to intimidate." Music writers do go on to argue that in his First Symphony, Brahms not only paid tribute to Beethoven, but he went on to banish Beethoven's ghost from there on in. The 2025-2026 season of the Williamsport Symphony Orchestra closes with the program titled Orchestral Wonders, featuring Symphony No. 1 of Johannes Brahms. Also, The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra by Benjamin Britten and the work that he varies, and that allows, in a certain sense, each musician in the orchestra to take a figurative bow at the end of this year's cycle. We had a chance to speak by phone with Gerardo Edelstein, music director and conductor of the WSO, about the music and his musings at the end of the season.
I can't believe that it's already the last concert of the season. We had a fantastic season of great music making with wonderful repertoire. And I think that finishing this season with Brahms Symphony No. 1, it's perfect because of the grandiosity of the work. And, you know, the whole story, how long it took Brahms to write it. I mean, he was so, I don't know if the word is to say so scared, but after, you know, Beethoven's 9 symphonies, he said, nobody can write a symphony anymore, especially number 9. And he respected Beethoven so much that said, no, I don't think I can do this. And it took him something between 14 to 20, 21 years to finish his symphony number 1. He was 43 years old when we have, you know, in the history of the symphony and classical composers, like Beethoven wrote his first symphony when he was 29, Schubert and Mozart much earlier, and Mahler was 28. So for him, it was a whole process. He wrote other orchestral pieces. He has 2 serenades. He thought that his piano concerto number 1 at one point, you know, with this long introduction, would be his first symphony, but then he decided not to complete it as a symphony. And well, finally, 43 years old, said, I think I'm ready. And he gave us, you know, just a fantastic piece that audiences are enjoying now tremendously.
What about the tone then? What's the mood or the various moods as he proceeds from first movement through the middle movements to the end?
Yes. Well, the symphony starts in a minor key. It's in C minor, and it's just quite dramatic. What is very interesting is that immediately when the Allegro starts, we can feel the Beethoven influence. You know, even with the famous pa-pa-pa-pam, pa-pa-pa-pam, you know, the famous 4 notes of, you know, Beethoven's Symphony number 5 shows up in this first movement. And you know, it has a kind of a more dramatic mood. But as we progress in the symphony, he gets much more lyrical. And in the last movement is glorious. And you will also find some similarity to the theme from the Ode to Joy. He even was told while composing, Glory was Clara Schumann. They were, you know, very good friends. And she's the one who actually encouraged Brahms to write a symphony. And she probably mentioned to him, hey, don't you think it's too close to Beethoven? He said, well, anybody who has a good ear can tell, you know, this is influenced by Beethoven. And he didn't care. And wrote this very, very majestic last movement with great tunes. And of course, we can hear Brahms' trademark, you know, his orchestration, some rhythmic developments, you know, hymiolas everywhere, and it's just much more rich harmonic language. So it is a piece of its own, definitely. But yeah, with some influence, no question. He was also very good friends of Robert Schumann, and Schumann wrote already, by then he wrote, I believe, all his symphonies, and there is some influence there too.
You mentioned Clara Schumann and Clara and Brahms' friendship, and I read, it wasn't in a gossip column, but I did read that there is a horn call that was said to be a shout out to her in the last movement. Is that true?
Well, there are all kinds of gossips and stories about it that we will never know. We certainly know that they were very close, and she made a big influence on him as well. Clara was a fantastic composer and fantastic pianist. She was the first female pianist who traveled around Europe giving concerts, and you know, she was quite recognized during her time, and definitely she had big influence on Brahms.
He did turn to her with his works and asked her to read through them, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he will not publish anything until he will get the approval from Clara.
You take us through the movements as you've just described them, Gerardo, and you come to this majestic finale, and it's not just the finale of Symphony No. 1 by Brahms. It's actually the finale of the Williamsport Symphony Orchestra season. Does that come across? Are you subconsciously feeling that as well?
Yeah. I mean, there is so much in the piece that kind of summarize the entire season, you know, all the things that we play this year and looking to the future as well. because we are already pretty much set with our next season that, believe it or not, is going to be the 60th anniversary of the WSO, and we are so excited to celebrate that with our audience in and, of course, the 250th birthday of America. So these two events will be the main focus of our next season.
One of the things that has always been clear when we speak with you, Gerardo, is your concern for young listeners and young musicians. And you have a piece of music on this program that really came about because of the interest for young people to learn about the instruments of the orchestra.
Yeah, it's a fabulous piece. It's one of my favorite pieces. And I have to say that it's geared not only towards children, but the adults will enjoy it as well, because it's almost like a lesson in orchestration. But other than that, it's just a fantastic piece of music, and I'm talking about The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra by Benjamin Britten. It's a piece that it was commissioned by the British Ministry of Education and also made for a film called The Instruments of the Orchestra. And yes, it was intentionally composed, for children, so then they get a little more familiarity with the orchestra. But, Britten didn't want to write something easy, with easy listening and just something that will only appeal to a young audience. He wrote a fantastic piece of music, and he actually chosen a theme from Henry Purcell, a piece that called Abdelazar Suite. This is a piece that Purcell wrote. It's incidental music for a play. And Britten just picked one of the movements, the rondo from that piece, and people will probably recognize the name of Henry Purcell as an early Baroque composer, and wrote variations based on that thematic idea, on that theme. And he goes through the entire orchestra, the different sections first, and then he goes to individual instruments in a brilliant, brilliant way. It's almost like you're a painter and you have all these palettes of colors and choices that you can choose whenever you want a specific color or also a combination of those colors. And the piece ends with a fantastic fugue, very difficult, so the adults will really, really appreciate. So what we will do at the concert, I will start with the original piece. We'll do it with just the principal strings, because this is a piece for strings and continuo. We'll play for the audience the rondo so then they can hear it in the original version. To the Britten piece, see what Britten did with that original music, and we'll have a narrator. Our assistant conductor, Rebecca O'Brien, will narrate the piece, so then the people in the audience who are a little less familiar with what is going on will know exactly what are we going to listen next.
And so the original intent for the piece, that it's educational, but it's not just that. As you say, it's so inventive, and we want to celebrate the orchestra when we hear what Britten does with the theme. Three cheers for the tuba.
Exactly. And when they ask me, why do you don't have a soloist for this concert? And I said, oh, wait a minute. We have 75 soloists in the orchestra for this piece. So each member of the orchestra is a soloist, because there are so many sections that they are showcased, not only the individual wind or brass instruments or percussion, but in the strings as well. And pretty much you can hear every single musician in the orchestra being part of this fantastic piece.
Let me ask you about the idea of variations. Gerardo composers and variations. We know Brahms did that remarkable piece, the variations on a theme that was attributed to Haydn. But not every theme is going to lend itself to varying, is it?
So theme and variation is one of the earliest forms that ever existed, because it's the simplest way, when you have just a tune, two, three, five, six, any notes, that you can embellish them, or you can play them from the end to the beginning, or you can change the rhythm, or you can add intermediate notes. So that's one of the easiest forms and early forms that many, if not every composer, uses immediately. And we can tell immediately, you know, the quality of the composer, or how brilliant or how inventive or smart the composer is, when we can still hear the melody, and how much the melody is worked out and changed, you know, just keeping the essence of the original theme. And you know, Brahms, as you mentioned, was really a genius and a master of the variation genre. The same thing as Beethoven and Mozart, and you know, all the great composers. They used it in very, very interesting and you know, artistic, fantastic way.
And I think it's going to be fun to hear it live, Gerardo, in the space where the musicians are making the music. Yes, we can hear it through even good speakers if we have a recording or listening on the radio, but to be surrounded by it, I think that makes it have an even greater impact, I would think.
Yes, and I always encourage people to, you know, just to come to our concerts, because the live experience of an orchestra cannot be replaced with nothing, with not even the best electronic equipment. And just to feel the, you know, the energy from the orchestra, to feel the intensity, the passion, the electricity, the, you know, all what you can think. It's only in person. You know, it cannot be duplicated with a recording. You know, and obviously, you know, the fact that things are happening at that moment and they are gone. You know, it's also something that people don't realize, that you can always rewind a tape. You can always put a pause on your phone and go do something else and come back. In a concert, you are there, present, and every second, you know, that something happens, it's special, and then it's gone, and you hope for the next.
In order to show you how a big symphony orchestra is put together, Benjamin Britten has written a big piece of music, which is made up of smaller pieces that show you all the separate parts of the orchestra. These smaller pieces are called variations, which means different ways of playing the same tune. First of all, he lets us hear the tune, or the theme, which is a beautiful melody by the much older British composer, Henry Purcell. Here is Purcell's theme, played by the whole orchestra together. Lets you hear the four different families of the orchestra playing the same Purcell theme in different ways. First, we hear the woodwind family, the flutes, the oboes, the clarinets, and the bassoons. Here comes the brass family, the trumpets, the horns, the trombones, and the tuba. Now Mr. Britten arranges the Purcell theme for the string family, the violins, the violas, the cellos, and the double basses. and of course the harp. Finally, the percussion family. All those drums and gongs and things you hit. After this, you will hear the theme by Prizzle, played once more in its original form by all four families together. That is, the whole orchestra.
The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, the opening of that piece by Benjamin Britten, performed by the New York Philharmonic under the direction of Leonard Bernstein, with narrator young master Henry Chapin. We just had a conversation with Gerardo Edelstein, music director and conductor of the Williamsport Symphony Orchestra, about the season finale 2025-2026, titled Orchestral Wonders, and The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra by Britten will be on the program with the Rondo from Abdelazer by Purcell to get a sense of that theme in its original form. And there will be a narrator, just as we heard young master Henry Chapin there, and it will be Rebecca O'Brien, the assistant conductor of the orchestra. Also on the program, the culminating work of the season, in fact, Symphony No. 1 of Johannes Brahms. It's in C minor, and it's Opus 68, and the concert will be this Tuesday, May 19th, at 7:30 p.m. at the Community Arts Center, 220 West 4th Street in Williamsport. For more information, on the web, williamsportsymphony.org, williamsportsymphony.org. Orchestral Wonders, this Tuesday, May 19th at 7:30, a concert that features the Williamsport Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Gerardo Edelstein, with a guest appearance by their assistant conductor, Rebecca O'Brien, in The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, in addition to those pieces, Symphony No. 1 by Brahms. Again, it's at the Community Arts Center, 220 West 4th Street, and that's in Williamsport. And for more information, williamsportsymphony.org, williamsportsymphony.org.